Accession number 28729, reel 2.
Rev that reel 2.
What are we on about? Oh, join the army, yeah, the day of, yes. Catching a train, going to London, getting another connection to Colchester. It was January 1950. Cold as hell. We were met at the train at the railway station by an army sergeant and a corporal. And there was a group of us, and it seemed to sort of all congregate on the railway station, on the platform. And I thought, where did all the lads come from? They've all got their little suitcases and their spare clothes in and so forth. And we were bunged into these lorries. It wasn't too far away from the railway station, just outside the town of Colchester. And these sort of foreboding looking buildings appeared on the horizon. Victorian buildings, about three stories high. I don't know if it was Miani Barracks or Gibraltar Barracks. I think it's Gibraltar Barracks. And then your life did change totally. Here I was, the only child, spoilt to death. And I was being bawled at as soon as we got there. Marched from one place to the other, double. I thought, what are they doing this for? It's like more like a punishment, like a jail sentence. All alien to us. But we thought, well, we'll comply, we've got to comply. They're shouting at us, and we seem to be getting on all right. And the uniforms they gave us, they must have been for some foreign element, because none of them fitted anybody. In fact, the big blokes used to get the small kit, and the small blokes used to get the big kit. Trying your berries on, none of them fitted. They went straight over your ears, and they said, you've got to put them in a bucket of water. I thought, well, why don't they give them the right sizes? And the boots, they were huge, great things. It was heavy. I've never had boots in my life. Anyway, eventually we got kitted out, and we found out that there was a tailor on the site, on the camp, and a little bit of money, 28 shillings a week we got. And for a little bit of money, we used to spend the vanity of it, isn't it? We got box pleats put into our blouses of a BD's best uniform. And we were taking a pride in ourselves, and we seemed to be learning the drill, being all right, and we had weapon training, which was rather exciting.
Well, can I take those through? Can you tell me about how you were introduced to drill and what it entailed?
Yeah, that was it seemed to come natural to you, most people, but there was always an awkward one that couldn't swing his arms in unison with his opposite leg. It used to swing with the leg, same leg. So if it was a left leg going forward, his left arm would go forward. But when he walked normally, they were all right. But as soon as they were told to march, they were marching like lobsters or frogs. And a lot of people didn't know the left from the right. It was amazing. If you don't think too hard at it, you can do it naturally. You just march normally, but they tried to get you into a position which was a little bit unnatural by pulling your shoulder blades back where we were slouching along. We didn't have a lot of stomach, so we used to shout out, pull your stomach in, chest out. Look up, don't look at the ground. It came natural. Marching is natural, but to get it into a uniform march as a group, as a squad, that was hard. But when you eventually did get it, and the word of command, you reacted on the word of command, the crispness of the crisp of the mark of the slamming your foot down when you turned or attention, you took a pride in that. There was a couple of blokes that were like, if you know about Corporal Jones and Dad's Army, there was a few of those that were always behind. But gradually they sort of drifted away from us. They were put into different squads. The chaps who couldn't march had ribbons tied on their arms. And that was to tell them from the left and the right, and also to swing the correct arm when they were marching. Then when they introduced weapons, they were so heavy. The rifles were so heavy. But you could start slinging them around all right. And again, vanity came in. because you like to hear the bang of the butts when they used to bring you up to arms, slope arms. And blokes were putting sixpences in the empty magazines, so when you hit the butt, they rattled. So we're getting a little bit, sort of vanity always comes out in the end, or pride. And they introduced this pride against the other squads. You've got to do better than them, you're better than them. Now, come on, let's see a good display. And sometimes we used to be on the parade ground late at night. That was a mark of punishment, but mark of the fact that we were not doing it correctly, or they had to justify to the RSM that they were pushing out their lads from through the rough and tumble of army life.
Who were the drill instructors?
Again, I've heard people say that they had bullies, but we didn't have any bullies at all. I know that one Lance Jack, Lance Corporal, he was a little bit on the sarcastic side, but I think he was an ignorant man. But the rest of them were reasonably intelligent. The sergeant was definitely officer material. He was a gentleman. But he had a command about him as well. And I think these blokes who had command in their voice, they got the reaction from the squad. And they didn't mess us about, whereas the other squad, some of the squads were messed about something terrible. They did try and keep us late at night, blancoing and polishing, and I think that was a way of getting to follow the instructions, not to question commands. Because I realised that later on in the army service that if you did question commands, it was detrimental to yourself and to the squad, because they'd observed something that you hadn't observed. So to get that command, the reaction to the command, that was good how they did that.
You mentioned that you were introduced to weapons training. What did that involve?
Well, the firing, the handling firstly of the weapons, the stripping down, the education of the individual parts of the weapon, either automatic weapons, rifles, bayonet, hand grenades, phosphorus grenades, the larger weapons that we use for anti-tank, which is called a Piat gun, flamethrowers. We had to disassemble all these, even by blindfold, and put them together again to oil them, clean them, and then eventually going on to the butts of the rifle range. That was enjoyable, really, because I found out I was natural. I'd never fired a weapon in my life. And I did have difficulty there because I'm ambidextrous. So I could fire the rifle or the Bren or any other weapon from left or right shoulder. Close left or right eye accordingly to get the sighting right. But some blokes couldn't even close one eye. They had to put a patch over their eye. But again, it wasn't a bad shot. I didn't sort of anticipate the recoil or the explosion. It didn't worry me that way. You had five rounds. That was just five rounds in a rifle when you first started. And I thought it was rather exciting. And then when he went up to the targets, 500 yards away, they weren't so bothered about you getting in the ball, but they were on about grouping, that you didn't scatter your rounds around. I used to get good groupings, and then you'd adjust the sights accordingly, and then gradually that you used to get the ball. And
how did you aim the rifle then? You mentioned the sights, but how did you aim using the sights?
Well, you had two sights. You had the foresight, which was on the end of the barrel, and the back sight, which is adjustable. And most weapons fire over 1,000 yards, and most weapons fire over a mile. But 1,000 yards is the accurate limit range of our weapons, anyway, 303. So you'd line your back sight with your foresight, and that'd give you a parallel line of your barrel and your rifle or whatever weapon you are. And adjust the back sight according to the range. And then you had a control of the trigger. Because on automatic weapons, even in those days, you used to fire very quickly and you could empty a magazine without thinking. So you'd have to count when you pull the trigger. Of the 1-2, 1-2, or 1-2-3, 1-2-3. And you'd have two or three bursts, and that was control. Because if you let the rifle or the weapon or any weapon you were firing go into automatic and it fired more than four rounds, you were nowhere near your target, because the power of the weapon used to lift the barrel away from your whatever you're firing at and go into the air. It was just a waste of time. But no, I enjoyed the weaponry training. I didn't look so forward to cleaning the things, because they soon carboned up with the explosion of the cartridges. The smell of the cordite was rather nice as well. That was
How did you have to clean them? How would you clean your rifle?
You'd boil the barrel out with boiling water, and then you'd dry it out with what was called a pull-through, which is about a yard of special cord with a weight on it and a loop at the end, and you'd get a soft cloth called before 4x2 and fold it in the procedure, put it in the loop, and then drop the weight through your barrel and pull. The rest of the weapon you'd have to dry out with an ordinary rags, springs, levers, nuts and bolts, outside barrels, even the wood with oil. And then you'd oil it with light oil and then wipe it. Because if you left too much oil on it, it used to, the dust, and they didn't like the looks of that. If you went on with an oily, on parade with an oily barrel or oily, though it was preserving the weapon, it wasn't in their appearance right. You had to have it dry. So you had to have a very light lubrication. And the weapon was kept to a very high standard, because we realised afterwards that you can get jam-ups, as we call them, and misfires. And it was mostly caused by reassembling the weapon incorrectly, or dust or grit getting into the breech or the trigger mechanism. So the more you attend to the weapon would never let you down.
Were you allocated a specific rifle?
Yes, we were, in so much that they gave you a number and the rifle corresponded with that number. But you didn't regard it as your own personal weapon, because you had to keep handing it into the armoury all the time. It was not until we came out of training, and then you went into the regular army, we call it regular army, a regular unit, then you were issued a weapon. In fact, two weapons sometimes.
You fired the Bren gun at that time as well, did you?
Yeah.
What was that like as a weapon?
I admired the Bren gun. It had a good reputation. It didn't let people down. It was rather heavy, 28 pounds, 30 pounds, especially with a loaded mag. But it was a stout, it looked a good weapon. That's what I liked about it. It was slim. It did have a recoil on it, but if you controlled it, pull it into your shoulder, same as with most weapons, if you controlled it by embracing the weapon, you wouldn't get so much bruising. Some chaps, they anticipated the recoil and the explosion, so they pulled the weapon away from the shoulder. And of course, the recoil used to bang straight into their shoulder, and they were huge bruises. Some of them, not broken collarbones, but they did have fractures. With a Bren gun, it did have a kick on it. But again, with responsible handling, that was a very good weapon, very accurate as well. And it was lovely when they had tracer bullets in. You could watch the tracer disappear in the distance. You didn't realise how fast they used to travel. And if they hit anything, they used to ricochet off and up into the air and then burn out. Especially at night time, when we did night time training. That was cool. I used to love training with that. The Sten gun, they brought a Sten gun in, and that was, I think it cost 28 shillings, near a week's wages. They used to make them. They were very tinny. And the safety situation was a pin going through the breech, and you'd hit it and it'd go through the breech into a securing hole on the outside of the weapon. But that used to come loose, and if it wasn't secured correctly or it had been worn by use, and you'd jump off a vehicle, it used to fire a couple of rounds, because the breech was so light with this terrible looking spring. It was a very flimsy little spring, and of course a lot of blokes got hurt by that. Imagine jumping off a 3 foot back of a lorry, and you jump on the onto the pavement below or the ground, and the Sten used to be, well, even on safety. That was mostly when we were in action. It wasn't so much on the training, because you wouldn't be allowed to walk around or move a weapon with a loaded magazine on. You'd have to took that. But that was later on. We found the Stens were not very good.
You mentioned bayonet training as well. Can you tell me how you did that?
Yeah, that was... You didn't know whether to take it serious or not, because they asked you to yell and shout and grimace as you were going forward with your bayonet on the end of your rifle, and to approach this flimsy-looking sack with straw in it, representing the enemy. And you had to charge this sack with venom and energy and scream at it. And we're not very good actors, and it wasn't a very good atmosphere. And of course I thought, well, let's try our best. And I noticed that the officers and the sergeant and the NCOs were, they used to smile when the bloke used to scream and shout. They thought, oh, that's good. So I thought, right, I'll have a go at this, I'll see if I can please them. And I went full belt at this sack, hanging in this wooden frame, and charged it with all the venom I could get. And of course I stabbed the thing so hard that the rifle went through the sacking. And when I tried to retrieve the rifle from the sacking, it wrapped round the foresight. It's just like a comedy match. And I could not get this rifle out of this sack. So I had to sort of go to the front of the rifle and pull it out like that. And it stopped all the proceedings behind me. All those blokes were all working themselves up to scream at this sack. I put the carbosh on that. So my intentions, the good intentions, turned out to be useless.
Is there a technique for when you stab the sack? Is there something you're supposed to do? Is it just charge straight out the sack? Or
you've got to have your arms... Your right arm is locked behind the butt of the weapon. You're pinching it between your elbow and your side. And your hands are away from the trigger mechanism, but on a small part of the butt. And your left arm should be as far extended as it could in a straight position, locked. It seems to be unnatural, but that's when you penetrate your enemy. You pull back just before you get to your enemy, and then thrust forward with a locked arm at the sacking or at the enemy. And as you withdraw, you twist left or right to break any bones or muscle that's got entangled with your bayonet. And you don't realise the bayonet can stay in the body, because the thrust is several tons, really. A person can thrust a long bayonet in. And they've got channels actually in the bayonet. And you thought that was just a decorative channel, but no, that's to sort of break the impact, the suction. So when we withdraw, it's got a channel to pull out on. And you twist as you pull out. I've never used it, thank goodness, in proper action.
How did it attach to the rifle?
It was... You put it on at an angle, on the end of the barrel, and the end of the barrel was grooved to engage the similar contrast or female connection with the bayonet. So you put it on with a slight twist, pull and then twist back on again. So it's locked in position. It's quite clever how they did it. And so therefore it's in line with the barrel and it's at a right angle. That was one of the flat blade, but they brought what we call a pig stick. And that was a long metal rod sharpened at one end. It was around about 6 to 8 inches long. And they thought that was easier to penetrate and withdraw. But they found out that if you penetrate certain organs and they didn't kill the person, then you were trouble, because you were so close to your enemy that he could sort of retaliate, even though he felt a bit discomfort at the time. But the blade would dismember more internals, because it had cutting blade on both sides. In fact, one of the top part was serrated, so it used to drag the gut out. They gave you areas of the body. I remember one sergeant said that try and go above the belly, because if you hit a person with a lot of weight on, you'd be flooded with his contents. So it's not really nice. It's water and fluid comes out of a person who's got a large gut. So you try and hit them just below the chest, preferably in the chest if they're short chaps, or in the bowel region, bringing it up.
Did you anticipate that you might have to use the bayonet at all?
Well, they're teaching us that, so I thought to myself, well, one of these days we may have to use them, but then we weren't sure of the enemies, because we checked on to talking in the barrack room where the wars were going off, and it was only Korea that they had close encounters or close combat. The rest of the world, they didn't have so much. It was mostly throwing things at you, bombs or bottles or fire bottles, and then running, and then you had to chase them in most of the rest of the world. And there was probably over a dozen skirmishes in the world that the British supporters were attending to, so they had plenty of choices, but only the Korea was the one that I'd heard that had close combat. And in fact, some of them had used the bayonets there. But no, we didn't put it. We were determined to use the rounds and use our guns and rifles and weapons, try and kill them before they got close to us. Because they thought that if you're going to use your bayonet, they're going to use their bayonets as well. So, and we had bayonet training as well to repel the opponents coming towards you with a bayonet. And you just had to click to, it's like a boxer. You flick it to one side to parry and then hit them with the butt. Because you're pointing at each other. So one or the other had to flick the opponents away and bring your butt up against the face or in the groin, but mostly in the face. You find out that even at the side of the weapon, hit them full in the face with the side of the weapon. It's funny how it's like when they said if you've lost everything, try and use as much material around you as possible. If you think that if you close encounters like that, if you throw a hand grenade, when the explosion occurs, that's the end of your weapon. And we thought, well, of course it is. The hand grenade, you throw it, and that's it. He said, well, hand grenades are a very good a tool to put in your fist. So, and I thought, well, what's he talking about? So you use the hand grenade as a solid fist. So you could swing your arm around, even though it'd break your knuckles, but you'd probably take three down with a hand grenade, and only take probably one.
Tell me about hand grenade training as well, please.
It was funny yet grotesque. You stand behind a wall of sandbags with an instructor, and you take the base plate off, and you prime it with your detonator. And the fuses are different lengths, so it's obviously different times. Probably 5, 7, 10, 14 seconds intervals of when you pull the trigger or let the pin go and throw. And we had probably 7-second fuse. Again, I was most surprised that some of the chaps couldn't throw. I'm going back a little bit in early training when they said they asked us to climb these ropes in the gymnasium. And I went to the top and then bottom again, and they said, well, you're going to do it with your boots on and your full kit. I thought, cool, that's going to be hard. But then I looked around and some of the chaps hadn't even got off the floor. They were townie boys. They'd never climbed a tree in their life. They hadn't got any strength in their shoulders. It's funny because I suppose they were brought up in streets. They were quite good at football, but they were no good in the shoulders. They just couldn't lift themselves off the ground. They'd jump, and that's it. In fact, they'd just slip. Whereas back in school, we had these gymnasium, a good gymnasium down here, and we used to have games called Shipwreck. And it was so gorgeous on there that you'd have to keep off the floor. You couldn't touch the floor, so you put the equipment out that you had to jump from raft to positions on the wall, on the wall bars and on the ropes and so forth. We had one bloke who always used to get up the ropes, pull the ropes either side of him, and just lock himself up in the ropes. Nobody could get to him. So the last one who wasn't touched was the winner. Again, it was physical training. And when I was surprised, I came back into the army, going to the army, and find out that the blokes couldn't lift themselves off the ground. And what chance they'd got to lift themselves off the ground when they got a full pack on, I don't know, but they couldn't do it. They were sent away for further physical training. These chaps were sent to, I think it was a place called Roman Way Camp in Colchester. Even the chaps who couldn't march properly didn't know the left from the right. The people who couldn't get on with weapon training, the people who couldn't take a command, they just couldn't take a command. Their minds used to go blank. And also a few chaps couldn't read or write. I felt very sorry for them, really.
You were saying that they couldn't throw the hand grenade, so what's the technique for throwing the hand grenade?
Go and go back to the hand grenade, Red. Right, so you're behind these sacks, the wall of sacks. You'd prime the hand grenade, put the base plate back, with a tool you tighten it up, and the instructor said, right, he said, you get hold of the lever with your right hand and pull the pin out and the ring with your left hand. And when I say throw, you throw. That's all you do. So I think it was a bit nervous as well, I suppose, but I thought it's like throwing a cricket ball. A bit heavier than that, but he said, right, throw. And as you throw, you relax your hand and the pin flies out. So it's engaging the detonator as you throw it. And he says, stay there until it lands. Well, that was the bit of a bit hard to do, that was, because you wanted to get down as soon as you let go. But no, they made you stand. So you see how accurate your throw was against a big tin or an object. Get down behind the sandbags and boom, explosion. A bit of stuff used to fly up. Well, the two people behind me, I wasn't taking much notice, but there was a bit of a fracas, and they were both climbing over the sandbags. A chap had thrown it up in the air, and it had gone straight up in the air and landed where they were standing. So they had to get over the other side of the sandbags, the instructor and the recruit, because they would have been killed with a hand. And also, when they left their arm was going backwards to get a leverage to throw the hand grenade, they'd let go of the hand grenade and it used to fall and roll 2 or 3 yards behind them. Again, I didn't realise how physically some of these people were inept. Never occurred to me that way.
You mentioned you had training with a Piat as well.
Oh, yeah, that was an anti-tank weapon. And the actual bomb, as they called it, was like a great big turnip with a spike on the end with fins on the other side. And you laid it into a tray, and it had a great big rod, which was the firing rod. So you'd have to either lay down or stand up and extend the weapon on its springs to load it. Now, if you kept hold of, when you fired the weapon and kept hold of the trigger, you'd have to reload it again. So that was a bit dangerous because it was an anti-tank weapon. So if you had to visualise that the tank was rolling towards you, you'd miss with your first shot, so you had to load again. So they had to either stand up or roll around trying to load this bloody weapon up. Which was, so let go of the trigger. A lot of people didn't. They just couldn't grasp it. But it was a funny weapon because once you fired the weapon, this thing, like a turnip, it used to throw itself out in front of you and then it swirl in a circular motion in front of you. And then you think, that's nowhere near the target. And gradually it straightened up and wham, straight into the target. And the spike at the end was so made that it used to penetrate armour and explode forward. It was very successful that way, but it was an ungainly weapon. Ungainly. And one chap he would never have got in the army normally, but he signed on for 22 years. He was 4 foot nothing. They hadn't got a helmet to fit him. The uniforms were specially made because he was so slight. He fired this weapon and he went back 2 yards when he fired it. He hadn't got any weight to control the explosion. Poor old Taylor, he had everything. When we used to go on route marches, his helmet would not stay on the top of his head. It was either to the front or to the back. He tried to stick it on his head and he was so small, so slight. He ended up as a Batman, so he had no worries about the physical thing after that.